So you were mentioning going down with Ted Edwards from Directorate of Naval Aviation down to the Sikorsky plant. Do you remember what year that would have been and which aircraft you were going down to evaluate?
It was really to talk to them about the requirement we had for the, or the necessity we had for folding rotors and the aircraft's capability to be operated from a ship.
So would that have been the 1960 staff requirement that they were working on?
It probably was, yes. Now, I can't remember what year it was when it went down there. See, I was in Ottawa for about 5 years there, and 53 to 58, so 59, I guess it was. Somewhere around there, anyway.
So the Sikorsky HSS-2, which is the Sea King, was not yet...
It was becoming available.
Becoming available.
Yeah.
But their most current helicopter would have been the S-58, which was in service with the RCAF.
Yeah.
Which the Canadian Navy borrowed for one of the trials.
Yeah. I'm not sure if the Sikorsky people had actually developed the rotor folding system at that time or not, for the helicopter we eventually decided on. It was either under development or just about finished development, because we were very pleased that it was possible to have the folding rotor thing. We went down again later on, and we actually saw one of them to do the job, folding rotors and what have you. It was an excellent thing. So that really resulted in the purchase of that type of aircraft. It was very good.
Now the power folding rotor blades and the tail pylon was something that came out of the trials with the RCN. This was a requirement that the RCN felt that they had to have in order to make this concept work.
That's right. Yes.
So from some of the documents that I've been through, it appears that the RCN suggested to Sikorsky that they pursue this and ask them whether it was possible. And the engineers at Sikorsky said that, yes, indeed, it seemed possible. They would see if they could...
Yes, this is one of the meetings that Ted and I were at down there.
How did you find the level of cooperation between the RCN and Sikorsky and their engineers?
First class.
First class?
No trouble at all. More than willing to do anything that they thought was feasible. Oh, yeah, it was no trouble at all.
Did, during your 5 years in Ottawa at headquarters, do you ever remember engineers or staff from Sikorsky coming to Ottawa to deal with any problems that the Navy may have been experiencing?
I don't recall any, but there probably were some. I don't recall, though. But we were getting manufacturers up there and engineers there all the time about various problems, so... I imagine Sikorsky must have been one that came up at the time.
Do you think that the cooperation was as good as it was because the market, the helicopter manufacturers were so competitive and were so keen on selling their particular aircraft types to any Navy that was interested?
Well, that certainly adds to the confusion of making a decision of which one you ought to get. That sort of thing was going on all the time. As I mentioned before, a number of companies came up to Ottawa with all sorts of proposals other than Sikorsky. And many of them were obviously not in business terribly long. So you had to sort of say, well, that's very nice of you to come up, but thanks a lot. Not easy to do. But
something that had to be done.
Yeah, Virginia said that after dinner.
Right. So when you went down there with the DNA down to the Sikorsky plant in Connecticut, would that have been a short visit to discuss these problems with the engineers down there?
Oh, no, it would be several days.
Several days.
Yeah. You can't do it all at once. Probably you have to give certain engineers in at one time and then some other engineers that come in for more details than another. Period and that sort of thing. So it would take a few days to do it.
So once once you had gone down there and discussed the problem with the engineers, was it left entirely in Sikorsky's hands to work out this problem?
Yeah, it was left to them, and they did.
And then people on your staff would have an opportunity to find out whether they had solved the problem to the RCN satisfaction?
Oh, yes. There would be a lot of liaison and that long at the technical level.
So
the operational level.
So you would send people down again to witness the demonstration
yep.
of the power folding rotor blades
sure.
or the tail Ooh. Pylon.
Yep.
As well as a number of other directorates that would have been interested.
That's right. Yep.
And so they all would have gone down.
Oh yes.
So you were did you hold the position as ACNTS Air as well as the director of aircraft engineering or air engineering for the entire 5 years, 1953 through 1958?
Yeah.
And what sort of, or were there any administrative changes during that 5 year change in title or blending or merging of various directorates into one? Or were you double-hatted for the entire 5 years?
I was double-hatted for the whole period of time. I think it was 5 years. It might have been more than 5 years, but I'm pretty sure it was 5 years. I left headquarters just a bit before the start of the integration thing. And that must have been about 1958 or 59 anyway. So it was about 5 years I was there.
5 years.
No, we had, I think, very, very successful time. Our liaison and our with the other directorates, with the RCAS, and with the companies, and even with DDP, very good.
Even with DDP.
Oh yeah,
I had read somewhere that there were some people that felt that DDP was taking on too much of a role and was determining whether or not a particular piece of equipment was the right one for the job instead of leaving it to the service to make those sorts of decisions.
This is correct in some cases. Now, there was a case when we started building the tracker aircraft, the S2Fs in Canada. Remember, de Havilland's got a contract to build them in Canada. And DDP wanted us to consider changing the engines in these aircraft from the ones that the USN had, which were Curtiss engines, Wright engines, and they wanted us to consider changing them to Pratt & Whitney engines, because Pratt & Whitney in Montreal obviously would like to have built engines for us, but their engines for us. And I and one or two members of our staff went over there, and I said, no way. I said, first of all, your engines are not as powerful as the ones that are in the aircraft now, so it's a step backwards if we do that. And I said, the USN have never tried them, so we're going to stay with the right engines. Well, that was the end of that, but that's the only time they really tried to interfere.
I was wondering if you could speak about, or if you have any recollections of any sort of competition between the RCN and the RCAF during your time at headquarters. I know that because of budgetary considerations, the chief of staff, Folks, for example, was always trying to get the services to cooperate and sit on joint committees and as it related to procurement issues like the helicopters.
Yeah.
So would you have had much to do with your opposite number in the RCAF as it related to procurement or evaluating particular aircraft?
Well, I used to have many pleasant discussions with the Ray Footed, Group Captain Ray Footed, who was the director of air engineering in the RCAF. And we never had any difficulties whatsoever along those lines, and I don't recall any time when, certainly at my level, there was an effort made to coordinate the purchase of one aircraft with the two services. I don't recall that happening at all. I thought it all went quite smoothly, as far at my level it was anyway.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add about your time in Ottawa while you were double-hatted in these two positions as it relates to the helicopter program?
No, the only thing I might add to that, which we've already talked about, is that it became apparent that VX10 was directly responsible to DNA for its operations. And it became apparent that really they should be more responsible to my staff people, because nearly all the work involved technicalities of the aircraft and the hold down system and so on. So that control was transferred to AC&TS Air. And I had on my staff then a staff officer who was the coordinator of all VX-10 activities in headquarters.
And his name was?
Well, let's see now. Who was it? The last one we had there. Yes, I don't remember his name at the moment.
What year would the transfer of responsibility have taken place?
Well, that probably was, I'm not sure of the year, but it would be probably in about 53, 54, somewhere around there.
Oh, that early?
I think so, yeah. I'm not sure of that because I haven't really looked at it too closely. It might have not occurred until 55. It's really mainly concerned with the helicopter business. It, no, not only that, of course, we had all the things to do with the other aircraft previous to that. For example, VX-10 had quite a lot to do with the Fury aircraft, the British fighters. And those aircraft were, I think we gave them up in about 1950 or somewhere around there. They were most unreliable things. The engines were hopeless on them, and they killed one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
And the VX-10 test flew some of them, and fortunately they didn't have any trouble, but they did some of the investigations in the thing. And then I sent DAE and party come down and really look into the engines, and they were stripped down at in our hangar at in Halifax, in the Shearwater hangar, and we found that we found the cause of the trouble in the aircraft engines, and there was no fix for it. And the Brits told us that no, they hadn't had any trouble. I've since learned that they had just the same trouble.
Right.
But, well, that's the sort of thing we did beforehand, but I think there were other aircraft we had to have VX-10 involved in, too. But that was when they were dealing with strictly technical things because of accidents. And DAE's people were very directly involved in it. And so that wasn't reason why, the reason. There were many other reasons why it was necessary from the point of view of administration to transfer the control of VX-10 and his activities over to the AC&TS Air group, the technical side of the house.
So is this something that you were actively promoting then yourself to have VX-10 report more
yep.
to AC&TS Air
yep.
as opposed to the Directorate of Naval Aviation?
That's right. I did this in conjunction with the Director of Naval Aviation, Ted Edwards, and he said, well, that makes good sense. We'll do that. So that was that.
So that was a decision
yep.
that was taken jointly by
yep.
by the two of you?
Yep.
And you didn't have to go further up the chain in order to get a decision
no,
on that?
No. That was done. This period.
And this was to have a greater degree of cooperation between VX-10 and your two directorates.
That's right.
As it related to the technical matters about the helicopters.
And the fixed-wing aircraft too, the Grumman aircraft as well, the autopilot business and stuff in that, which I think I talked about before. That was very necessary to have the of course, liaison with the EXTEM.
Could you briefly describe what the responsibilities were for the Directorate of Air Engineering as opposed to ACNTS Air?
I've forgotten his terms of reference were now exactly, but essentially he was responsible for the airworthiness of the aircraft. In all aspects of the thing.
All aspects. Yeah. So that would include electronics, avionics, the airframe itself, engines.
Yeah, and if it was electrical problems after it, it included the airframes, the engines, and all the hydraulics and all that sort of thing, anything mechanical on it, that was all his responsibility. And when it became a technical one, well, we just liaised directly with the technical staff, and they came and did their bit. There was no difficulty at all.
So who assumed those two positions once you left headquarters in 58 59?
I'm not sure if they were assumed by anybody. I don't think John Dougherty came back into the fold. He might have done for a short period of time. It was almost the time, you know, that the forces were breaking up.
Was it 64 for integration?
Yeah.
Starting about 63?
Yeah, starting around then, in about that.
So where were you posted following your 5 years in Ottawa?
Well, I was posted down to the Atlantic Command as the command technical officer, which I eventually became the assistant chief of staff for operational readiness of the fleet. So that's what I was doing down there.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's much like an aviation job in a way, except that I didn't have aircraft, I had ships.
Right. So your time and responsibilities as it related to the helicopters and VX-10 were over once you had left headquarters.
Yes,
then.
Yes, yeah. One rather interesting little aspect I thought of the that job was the Chief of Operational Readiness in Halifax, staff of the flight officer there, was that one day I went down to just to look over a ship that had been told to go and attend some lobster festival or something like that up at PEI. It's one of these PR things or public relations thing. So the ship that was detailed to go off was a fairly old destroyer called Cayuga. So I'd better go down and have a look at this ship. And I went down and I went around the ship. And then I went around and looked at the engine room outfit with the engineer officer. And it was most unsatisfactory. Everything in the ship was most unsatisfactory. And in fact, the ship wasn't really seaworthy. So I came back to the, I told the commanding officer of the ship they weren't going to go anywhere. You're not seaworthy enough to do it. And so I went back to the office and I reported to the then chief of staff, who was Admiral Budge, now is Admiral Budge, retired. He was then a commodore. And he was a bit of a religious person too. But anyway, I went into his office and I said, "Sir, I've just grounded Cayuga." He said, "My God, where?"
So what were your terms of reference then as the Director of Operational Readiness in Halifax?
Just to make sure that the fleet was operational ready. One of the troubles that we've always had, apparently, I saw when I went down there in the fleet, unlike the aviation business, you knew if you're a squadron leader or in command of a bunch of aircraft, you knew which ones could do what and how many could do what. You know the operational capabilities of them. Well, down there, as far as the admiral's staff was concerned, he really didn't know what the condition of his ships was. So I thought, well, this is a hopeless situation. For instance, he told the Cayuga to go off, and she wasn't capable of going anywhere. And so after that, I thought, well, we'd better do what we used to do in the aviation game. We'd have a reporting system. And so we we developed a reporting system which covered the whole ship. I've forgotten what we call it now. Anyway, it was an operational readiness reporting system that the ships had to report in daily in a classified message. And in that classified message, they indicated whether everything was okay, whether armament's okay, electrical department's okay, communications okay, fuel okay, engines okay, everything you can think of was all there. And if it wasn't okay, could you fix it yourself and how long would it take you? That sort of thing came in. So we knew the condition of the ships.
Right.
Romeo reporting it, we named it, the Romeo reports, and they came in quite regularly, and it really gave us a good idea of which ships could do what, and it certainly gave the commanding officers a good idea of what their ships were capable of too. I remember the captain of Provider came along one day and said, "This is the best thing that's ever happened. I didn't know my ship was this good or that bad." So that worked out quite well.
Do you have any comments regarding the feelings of the admiral or the fleet and Canada's, as it relates to Canada's commitment to NATO and Sakhalin? We've got basically the Saint Laurent class destroyers, which are 6 years old, that are now going in for refit in order to put the hangars on and the flight deck and all the machinery into the machinery spaces. So you're taking what are virtually brand new ships out of the fleet for a lengthy period of time in order to embark the helicopters. Are we not then meeting our NATO commitment? Was there any regret, I suppose, or any concern expressed by what would be now MARCOM?
I don't know if there was any regret expressed other than the terrible regrets that people had that we have to do this, older ships and refurbish them instead of getting new equipment. Now, of course, this was all a financial problem. And if it was necessary to do it, it had to be done. Now, I presume our position was operationally weakened during the time that these ships were going in, and they might have gone in for a prolonged period because of the cost of doing the job, for one thing. But I haven't heard any complaints about this. I don't know of any complaints, say, from the NATO people or anything like that. You see, the same thing could happen to the USN. It's most unlikely that they have so many things, but their position is not always constant operationally. But no, I don't know of any harsh words between the two outfits at all.
Just one final question. During your time in headquarters, the 5 years that you were there and holding down these two positions, looking back at the success of this entire program, what would you attribute that success to, based upon your own personal experience in Ottawa?
I think one of the greatest, I mean, the helicopter business.
That's correct.
One of the greatest things contributing to the success of it was this development by the Ferry Aviation of this bear trap system, holding the aircraft down and putting it in a hangar. That really cinched the thing as a success. If we hadn't had that, manhandling one of those big aircraft would be difficult.
I was thinking also that the RCN had a number of talented engineers and pilots, test pilots, people in headquarters and out at the commands that all contributed in one way or another to this successful, very successful program. And would you agree with that comment, that it's due in large measure to the RCN and its people as well?
Oh, yes. You couldn't do it without them.
I was thinking of one name that keeps coming up in the documents was Commander Johnson, I think, who was also an engineer.
Yeah, Moose Johnson.
In 55, 56, and he, from what I've read, had suggested that the RCN investigate the possibility of capturing and hauling a helicopter to a flight deck. And he struck me as being a person that was somewhat ahead of his time.
That must have been Moose Johnson. What year are you talking about roughly now?
55, 56.
Yeah, it could be then, because he became very ill about that time, too.
Lieutenant Commander J.H. Johnson, engineer, in the Director of Air Engineering in 1955.
Yeah, I guess that's it. Moose Johnson. Stop that thing for a moment. I'll look it up.